What Really Happened radio show. Putting America first, second, and third. Here is your host, Michael Rivero.
Hello, hello. This is the What Really Happened show on RBN, putting America first, second, and third. I'm Ryan Dawson. I'm filling in for Mr. Mike Rivero. It's his show. I'm just a substitute. This is my last day of substitution. I've had 3 days in a row. Some of you may know me from my films. I did one on 9/11 and the Iraq War called War by Deception. That's up free on YouTube. I also have a lesser-known new film on 60 years of covert activities called Decades of Deception. You can find that on Vimeo, or you can order a DVD. I worked for Sibel Edmonds on Boiling Frogs Post. I did a weekly radio show for her for a year. I also worked on Liberty Radio, and I'm currently running my own podcast on ancreport.com. And on ancreport.com, you can find my Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, forum, email, etc. I do have a guest today for the third hour, Mr. Kaelin Babcock. He is coming on to talk about the new secrecy law in Japan. However, you can call in during that hour or any hour. The number to call is 800-313-9443. Give me your 2 cents or ask a question or get an argument or whatever it is you like. Okay, on to the news. The Bernanke has hit the fan in South Sudan, the world's newest country. If you don't know what I mean by Bernanke, it's a, it's a four-letter word that I can't say on the air, but it's something brown that smells like John McCain. And seriously, his breath, I met John McCain. I met him when I went to lobby, and that guy's breath smells like he rolled a Bernanke around in his mouth. He is as smelly as Richard Pearl is ugly. But I guess I shouldn't say I ran into McCain because that means that I met a terrorist sympathizer. The NSA should be knocking on my door because this John McCain got a photo op taken with a bunch of organ-eating kidnappers and murderers in Syria and then claimed ignorance. Of course, his father also helped whitewash the Zionist state's massacre of American sailors. That's with the USS Liberty, but I digress. So in Sudan, Britain has pulled out all of its embassy staff from South Sudan. I shouldn't say Sudan. I'm used to saying Sudan, but as of July last year, it's now North Sudan and South Sudan, and they already have embassies, and the British are pulling everyone out. Why, you may ask? Well, yesterday, as I reported, there was an attempted coup, which failed. Hundreds of people died, which is a low number for either one of the Sudans, but the violence is continuing, and what we have here is a situation where the president's forces and the loyalists are squaring off against a mutiny by a general. His name is Gaddat Yaak. That's spelled Y-A-A-K. I hope I pronounced that right. But General Gaddat's forces have attacked a base this morning, or I guess tonight, depending on your time zone. And reportedly, they have control over some heavy artillery and tanks, so this could slip into a full-on civil war. They attacked a base in Pandahar. So far, it's still military versus military, and the civilians haven't been pulled into the crosshairs yet. So it hasn't escalated to something like Syria, and it's not filled with mercenaries yet. The Salafis haven't been paid off and driven down there by the Saudis. Not yet, anyway. But, of course, it could escalate. The civilians are already starting to predictively divide along tribal lines. That's very predictable. But this, together with all the well-covered violence in North Sudan, in Darfur, is why so many people, if they can, are fleeing the country. And along with the Brits, the Americans have flown there, 120 diplomats out of the country. They don't want to repeat a Benghazi incident. And so they're all now in Kenya, next door. Kenya, by the way, passed a draconian bill where journalists will be fined $230,000, and $230,000 in Kenya means nobody has $230,000, put it that way. So if they breach a code of conduct, now breaching code of conduct means saying anything the government doesn't want you to say, basically. So they have their own secrecy law passed in Kenya. And you can see that. I call it the Snowden effect. He's gotten all these governments in a complete panic about leakers. and independent media. Now, were it not for the web, none of that would matter, because the corporate-controlled media, if there wasn't an internet, they would have just hung Snowden out to dry. You can see how they attempted to do that. They did the same thing with Tyson, Manning, and other whistleblowers, or they just simply ignored them. But because Snowden was clever enough to get a real journalist like Lynn Greenwald all his information, and he did everything the right way, and because Glenn could go on the web, not only The Guardian, but also go on the web and disseminate that information, that's why it had any effect at all. So the internet is already breaking the media monopoly. But getting back to Sudan, there are a lot of African migrants from multiple conflicts in North Sudan and South Sudan who have fled the country as refugees. And you've got equally, if not worse, conditions in Ethiopia and, in, of course, in Mali for the last 9 months anyway, with the French intervention in Mali. Eritrea has in its wars, and then, of course, Somalia. So a lot of these Africans are making their way up to Israel. It's landlocked that they can get through. Egypt, of course, has had its conflicts as well. So it's really the closest place it's supposed to. It's supposedly a democracy, although I would say it's just an ethnically racist. It doesn't matter if it's democratic or not. I mean, it is an intrinsically racist. I wouldn't even say apartheid state. I would call it more something akin to a Nazi-like state, because they just murder all of their neighbors. But these migrants are making their way to Israel, and, of course, they're treated less than the rank of a second-class citizen. They're not allowed to have work permits. They're not allowed to earn their own living. And these are skilled people. These are all manner of people. But the fact that they're black and not Jewish is all that matters, because a lot of the Zionists in Israel, which is the majority, want a Jewish state. And by that, they don't mean Jewish culture. Some of them do, but the Zionists, that they mean Jewish as in their own heads, a bloodline. They want to have a Jewish majority. That's the threat of the Palestinians as well. It's not the kids throwing rocks or the suicide bombers, which there hasn't been one since 2005. It's the threat of them having babies and there being more Palestinians than there are ethnic Jews. That's all there is to it. They want to have a state that is racially pure. We've heard this before. They can't possibly fathom the idea of just living with each other the way every other country in the world does it. Maybe not North Korea, that'd be the one exception. But in America or anywhere else, anybody can live anywhere, and they're all considered Americans. But in Israel, you have to be Jewish, and you have to be European Jew if you want to be on the top of the pecking order. But a couple of non-Zionist Jews made a great, or in a short documentary film about the African migrants, most of whom are from the Sudans, and who made it to Israel. That was Max Blumenthal and David Sheen. Some would paint them on the left, but I, you know, activism is activism. And Blumenthal and Mr. Sheen went to Israel and made a documentary of the just abhorrent racism pervasive in society, not only supported by the state, but just at large. Israelis are the core of their Jewish identity is racism. Now I'm pointing out the anti Zionists who made this film are also Jewish from the diaspora, but you know, I don't like these kind of labels or anything. It doesn't matter. I mean, their racism is fostered in Israel from the time people are born. They are brainwashed into racist beliefs, and it's really sad because that's already negative in and of itself, and also it causes a backlash toward their own group, because that is what collectivism does. That's the stupidity of collectivism. And I will be playing a clip from their film right after the break. Hello, welcome back. This is the What Really Happened show. I am Ryan Dawson, filling in for Mike Rivero tonight, depending on your time zone. I was talking about South Sudan and also Israel, and I'm talking about African migrants into Israel, and I mentioned a film by David Sheen and Max Blumenthal. And I'd like to play just 2 minutes, a little less than 2 minutes from that film. Can we cue to the first clip?
What מלקות, פסיכופטים, אנשים שרק מחפשים איך לרצוח אותי בעיניים שלהם. אבל אף אחד לא מאמין לנו. אנחנו גזענים. אנחנו גזענים כדי לרצות לשמור על החיים שלנו ועל השפיות שלנו. אז אני גאה בלהיות גזענית. אני גאה בלהיות גזענית. אם אני גזענית בשביל לשמור על החיים שלי, אז אני
While protests raged in the streets against the presence of asylum seekers from Africa, the man who held the power to determine their fate, Deputy Prime Minister Eli Yishai, demanded their expulsion.
אם יתנו לי את כל הכלים, ואני פועל להשיג את כל הכלים, וזה לא קל. אם יתנו לי את כל הכלים בלי יוצא מן הכלל, תוך פחות משנה לא יישאר בארץ ישראל אפילו מסתנן אחד.
And the few isolated Israelis who dared to protest, like this woman, were met with a harsh backlash. At the anti-African rallies we documented, one figure was ubiquitous, a member of Knesset named Michael Ben Ari. In August 2010, we interviewed him at his Knesset office.
יש להם שם בית. מה זה גירוש? איזה גירוש? הם שווים הבית. כל מדינה בעולם מתוקנת הייתה עושה את זה. נהפוך להיות מדינת הגירה, אבל יש כאלה שעוינים את המדינה. ולכן הם רוצים להפוך אותה למדינת אזרחי כל העולם. נביא לפה מיליון אפריקאים, חצי מיליון פיליפינים, שניים, שלושה מיליון סינים, ושלום על ישראל.
למה זה מאיים שיהיו פה מיליון אפריקאים?
זה מאיים כי לא תהיה פה מדינה יהודית. המדינה שלנו, המדינה שלנו, המדינה שלנו, תקשיב, המדינה שלנו שונה ממדינות אחרות. המדינה שלנו היא מדינה יהודית, מדינה יהודית ודמוקרטית. זה איזון מאוד מאוד לא פשוט, זה יכול להיות תרתי דסתרי במקומות מסוימים. זאת אומרת, דברים סותרים זה את זה במקומות מסוימים. במידה ותביא לפה מיליון אפריקה, היא תחדל מלהיות יהודית. היא תחדל מלהיות יהודית. אנחנו נלחמים. לדוגמה, בתופעה של התבוללות. בעולם ישנה התבוללות של 70-80 אחוזים במקומות מסוימים בעולם. זאת אומרת, עם ישראל הולך לאיבוד. לי, עם ישראל יקר.
Ben Ari is known for leading nationalist marches through Arab neighborhoods inside Israel, where he antagonizes, intimidates, and menaces Arab citizens. On the holiday of Hanukkah, Ben Ari led a rally at Levinsky Park, a public space in South Tel Aviv that has become home to many Africans who were denied work permits and the ability to afford housing.
אנחנו נגיד פה לכל הצבועים האלה, לכל הצבועים, אתם רוצים לעזור לאפריקאים, תיסו לאפריקה. אתם רוצים לתת להם אוכל, לכו תיתנו להם שם. זאת המדינה היהודית היחידה שיש לנו.
Earlier in the year, at an anti-African rally in Tel Aviv that was attended by thousands, Ben Ari was joined by lawmakers from the governing Likud party and other mainstream politicians. Minutes after the rally, 1,000 Israelis rioted, attacking African homes and businesses and assaulting any African they found in the street. Here is footage shot by one of the participants in the riot, a supporter of Michael Ben Ari. Days later, Yulia Shmuelov-Belkovich, at the time a legislator from the centrist opposition party Kadima, called for Israelis who advocate for the Africans to be locked in prison camps alongside the asylum seekers.
אני מסכם את הדיון.
דרך אגב, מעבירה אותם גם לאותו מקום שאנחנו בונים עכשיו את המחנות, שיעבדו שם.
According to the Israeli Coalition Against Racism, incidents of racist incitement by Israeli public figures doubled in 2012. In many cases, the targets of their hateful invective were not Palestinians, but African migrants. Chief among those targeting the presence of Africans in Israel is a corps of hundreds of state-appointed rabbis, including some of the premier religious authorities in Israel, who issued a letter forbidding Jews from renting apartments to the African asylum seekers and any other non-Jews. Here is a rabbi that we filmed, one of many who labored to promote the religious edict.
לחץ כזה לאחר שדיברנו עם בני הקהילה שלנו והסתובבנו לנסות להקשות עליהם.
Though painted as an existential threat, the fact remains that Africans in Israel pose no known security threat to the country. None of them have engaged in acts of terrorism against Israel, and very few, if any, hold anti-Israel opinions. Most are eager to contribute to the prosperity and well-being of the country. So why are they being demonized? And why is the government so determined to deport them? Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu previously warned that if the level of Arab citizens of Israel exceeds 30% of the general population, Israel could become a binational state and would lose its Jewish character. With tens of thousands of non-Jewish African migrants living in Israel by 2010, Prime Minister Netanyahu warned that their presence increases the looming threat to the Jewish character of the state.
אנחנו הצלחנו לבלום את הכניסה של המסתננים מאפריקה לישראל אחרי שהיינו באיום של כניסה של מאות אלפים. החודש לא נכנס מסתנן אחד לערי ישראל. זה כבר כמה חודשים שאנחנו משיגים את התוצאה הזאת. בחודש הקרוב אנחנו נשלים את בניית הגדר לאורך גבול סיני. ועכשיו אנחנו עוברים לשלב השני, וזה השלב של החזרת המסתננים שכבר נמצאים כאן.
Already, the Israeli Knesset has amended the Anti-Infiltration Act it passed in 1954 to prevent Palestinian refugees from returning to their property. Under the new version of the law, non-Jewish migrants can be arrested on site and held in prison without trial for 3 years or more before being deported. To hold the migrants and asylum seekers before deporting them, Israel's government has built what it calls an accommodation center in the Negev Desert. Blueprints of the center reveal that it will be, in fact, the largest prison of its kind in any industrialized nation. Currently, about 2,000 Africans languish in the detention center in what human rights groups describe as substandard conditions. This footage we shot outside the prison shows how vast it is. A comprehensive look at the interior of the prison camp has never been presented to the general public. Until the Israeli government is able to resolve the crisis, the chaos in the streets continues. This past New Year's Eve, we followed a mob of ultra-nationalists as they marched through South Tel Aviv, demanding the expulsion of non-Jewish Africans. After the march, the ultra-nationalists gathered at the headquarters of Michael Ben-Ari's Strong Israel Party, and that's when we were recognized as left-wing journalists. While protests raged in the streets against the presence of asylum seekers from Africa, the man who held the power to determine their fate, Deputy Prime Minister Eli Yishai, demanded their expulsion.
What they're saying there, you heard the beginning in English, and I'll just go over what they're saying. There was a whole crowd full of these racist Israelis that had gathered, and a man was saying, it's not too late, we can take action tomorrow. Start rounding up the infiltrators. We don't need to wait for the Supreme Court. We don't need to wait for anything. Round them up tomorrow morning. And then a woman came on and said a bunch of horrible racist things as well, referring to them as Bernackis and spit and psychopaths, and voiced her opinion on that matter as well. Now, they're not even allowed to have work permits to earn a living for themselves. Israel doesn't want migrants unless they're Jewish. You get a free ticket if you're Jewish to come to Israel, which it's great to give whoever you want a free ticket to live in your country if you want, but this is motivated by racism. And it doesn't make you racist to point out blatant racism in a country that ethnically cleanses people. And I'm usually talking about the Palestinians, but things have to be said about these African migrants as well. They've built giant detention centers for them in the desert. And they passed a law, a new law called the Anti-Infiltrators Law. They already had the original Anti-Infiltrators. They call them Infiltrators Law, which is what already denied Palestinians the right of return, the right for them to return to their homes, which were in Israel, still are in Israel. And they're forced either to live in the open outdoor prison in Gaza or the constantly colonized area in the West Bank. But the new law says that non-Jewish immigrants in Israel can be arrested on site, and it's easy to identify somebody from Africa because they would be black. They just look at the physical characteristics. They can be arrested on site, and they can be held in prison for 3 years without a trial. Just doesn't matter. Oh, there's a black guy. Grab him if they want to. Put him in jail for 3 years. And then when and if he or she does have a trial, they're probably going to be deported back to somewhere in Africa. This is really, seriously, the level of send them back to Africa that you might hear some neo-Nazi group preach, send them back to Africa in the U.S. or Canada or somewhere. That's what they're doing. The difference is these aren't teenagers. Well, some of them are. And this isn't in the 1960s or 50s. This is this year. The film was made last year in 2012 with grown adults and political parties with support of the state and legislation. Send them back to Africa legislation. It's the epitome of racism, and yet this is not in the news. If Iran did something like this, imagine this. If Iranian politicians made a law to kick out the whatevers, non-Persians, could be arrested on site and put in prison for 3 years, and they just deported people back to wherever. They wouldn't grant them work permits, and they were just racist crowds in the street and politicians supporting them, yelling racist slogans at people, sometimes attacking people. Do you think that would be on the news? Because anything Iran does, even things they don't do, make it to the news criticizing them. That would never happen. You couldn't do that anywhere. If that was happening in Canada or the United States, where there are groups, I mean, it could never be supported by a politician, but even if there were just local groups that went around saying send blacks back to Africa, even though most blacks in America are been there for many generations, but whatever. I mean, Asians, whoever, Mexicans or something, to send them back. I mean, it would never happen, not even in Arizona. I mean, that would never happen, and I'm talking about a certain cop there. But in Israel, they can get away with it. And not only can they get away with it, they do it without any press coverage. And this is self-censorship. I mean, this is a story. And it took some independent journalists to go there and film and make a little free film on YouTube about it. But just imagine this happening in your city or something. Why isn't this covered? That's the bigger picture. That Israel's a racist state is a no-duh Sherlock kind of thing. People know this is going on, but you have to ask yourself, why not one journalist from CNN or Fox or any of these newspapers wrote a report about it or even spent 2 minutes of their time saying what happened. They can't. They would lose their job in a second because that the press is Zionist occupied. They rarely ever criticize anything the Pentagon doesn't want them to criticize, whether it has to do with Israel or not. But if it's both, which it is in this case, they're never going to talk about it. They'd be fired. If somebody in a university talked about it who didn't have tenure, like Norman Finkelstein, they'd get fired, or Ward Churchill. There is no freedom for journalism. There's no freedom for academics to talk about an issue like this. When we, you know, in South Africa during that apartheid, people spoke about it. You could say any other manner of racism on that degree, you have freedom of speech. But when it's Jewish racism, you're not allowed to talk about it. And on top of that, if you do, you're labeled racist for pointing out somewhat other groups' blatant racism, which I find utterly disgusting. These camps, they have some outdoor prisons, and yesterday, more than 100 African migrants abandoned their detention center to try and march on occupied Jerusalem in protest of the new anti-infiltrators law. Bibi Netanyahu even got up on TV and talked about them as infiltrators. It's just disgusting. But Israel views the 50,000 or so Sudanese and Eritrean migrants as infiltrators. And I'll speak a little bit more about this after the break, and then we're going to get into some NSA stuff and Iceland and Bitcoins and many other subjects. So see you soon. Hey, welcome back. This is the What Really Happened show, putting America first, second, and third. This is Ryan Dawson. I'm filling in for Mike Rivero. The number to call in if you have any comments or questions is 800-313-9443. And if you live very far away and you'd like to use Skype, the Skype handle that you need is Kelly RBN Live, and then the number 2, Kelly RBN Live 2. And you can Skype in like that. I have a guest coming on in the third hour. I was, before the break, we were talking about African migrants in Israel and their blatant racism and the new anti-infiltrators law. They organize a protest. In some of the detention centers, they are allowed outside in the day, but they have to be back in their jail cell by night. And so what they tried to do is in their window of freedom, march on Jerusalem and try and bring attention to this. Of course, no cameras would be there. It will never make the news. This is about probably the biggest channel or venue for it that it's going to have, sadly. But we're aiming to change all that. Now, speaking of other victims of Israel's blatant racism, I'd like to talk about Gaza. I mentioned it yesterday and ran through it. But Gaza has had floods. There's been some strange weather. Even Egypt has had snow. Thank you, global warming, and I'm being sarcastic. But a lot of the damage, just like when we were talking about North Carolina a couple days ago, is man-made. And it's not just the Palestinian government or infrastructure. It's that it wouldn't be in the conditions, the dismal conditions that it is in, were it not for the Israeli blockade and the constant and routine bombings by the Israeli state into Gaza. They blow up anything with a roof. The one sewage treatment facility they had, it ran out of electricity because Gaza has had a fuel shortage. And this isn't something that, you know, happened overnight. I remember probably the biggest coverage it ever got was from a group of comedians, some Palestinian comedians, did a spoof on the famous Jean-Claude Van Damme Volvo commercial where he did the epic splits onto Volvo trucks. It's a pretty cool commercial, and I like Van Damme. He actually inspired me a lot in my own pursuit of martial arts through my career. But what the Palestinians did is let me explain what Van Damme did first. He did the Chinese splits sideways as the cars moved apart, his legs got further apart, and then he sat in the splits, and that was to show the controlled steering of the automobiles. Well, the Palestinian comedians did the same kind of stunt on some regular cars. However, as they panned out and the cars were moving apart, and he didn't go all the way down in the splits either, you saw that five guys were on each car pushing it. They weren't driving them. And that was to show that they don't have any gasoline. And that's because it's blocked. And they can't import it in. They can't buy it. They don't have their own oil to process in the gasoline. And so they've been forced to buy gas from the Israelis at like double the price, which most of them can't afford. And so they've had a gas shortage. And because of that, is the reason why they ran out of electricity on their sewage facility. And because of that, when the floods hit and it flooded the sewages, a lot of this untreated sewage rose up into the streets. It's made a big brown Bernanke River, which has it's reached the houses, businesses, everything. The kids are getting skin rashes, and it's disgusting. I mean, they're living and squalling in actual Bernanke. And you know what that word means, I already explained. And there's no help. The Israelis sent in 4 pumps, I think, and some just basically nothing to help clean up a little. And, of course, they're selling them gas now at a very hiked-up prices. But there's been no international attention on this, and nobody's helping. Of course, the Egyptians aren't going to do anything. They're right next door to Gaza. They could easily bring in concrete, fuel, etc., but under the new /old military junta, they're not going to lift a finger. They got their IMF loans. They've been paid off to look the other way, the same as it was when Mubarak was in charge. And really, even under Morsi, although that was an improvement, it was nothing to get too excited about. And they have their own problems there. But the people in Gaza, they get slaughtered routinely, and now they're living in their own waste, which they cannot clean up because of the fuel shortage. And I just think that's horribly sad. And yet we give the Zionist state, which cut them off from their fuel, billions of dollars every year. This is not really foreign aid, because foreign aid is usually given to a country in the form of predatory loans. What they do with Israel is they give them the money at the beginning of the year in cash, and then they always forgive the loan. So basically, they just gave away a bunch of money. The only, earmarking or attachment to it is that they have to recycle 75% of it on U.S. arms industries. But that gives them 25% left over to funnel into the lobbies to go repurchase Congress, and with that, continue the flow of money back to Israel. So you just take a portion to buy a bunch of armaments that they want anyway, which puts a little check in all the MIC goobers' boxes, and then they use the rest to lobby Congress to purchase their politicians, who, of course, yield to every single one of Israel's demands, including dragging the U.S. into wars, as they did in Iraq, the conflict in Syria, and the target that's been put on Iran. And the last presidents to challenge that, of course, is John Kennedy and then his brother in the Justice Department. And we went over yesterday what happened to both of them, which is really, really sad. But I have some good news, somewhat good news. I'd like to talk about the NSA for a little bit. I'm probably going to run up into the break, but I'm going to start into this anyway. A caller yesterday brought this up. He asked me about a case, and I thought I'd give you some more details about what happened last week. A federal judge in the United States, Richard Leon of the U.S. District Court in Washington, ruled, this is last Monday, by the way, I think it was the 11th or something, but he ruled that the NSA's blanket phone tapping of everyone in America is a violation of the Fourth Amendment protection of unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, I think that's something we all knew, but the reason this matters is this is a federal judge saying it. This isn't Ryan Dawson saying it. This is somebody who counts saying it. And that was his ruling. He called it almost Orwellian technology. That's a quote. I mean, of course, that's referring to George Orwell, if you don't know. And he put his ruling on hold to allow the government to appeal. But this is a major step forward. The NSA, like, well, every government organization that ends with a vowel, especially A, TSA, the CIA, the NSA, the DEA, it really has nothing to do with what it claims that it's supposedly the reason why it exists and what it's supposed to be doing, because they're not fighting terrorists. They're not even looking for terrorists. They're searching for dirt with which to keep the status quo in charge, in line. That is their whole purpose. It's a huge waste of money. They've got that giant facility out in Utah. I hope they cut the water off to it. There is a movement in the state of Utah to cut off the water to the facility they have there for the NSA. And that's pretty fascinating because they need all this water to cool off all these computers that they're grabbing your metadata with. And they're actually, it would be perfectly legal if the state of Utah had the cojones to do it and gets enough support to do it. They could just cut off the water, and then the NSA is either going to have to ship it in from somewhere else, or they're going to have to shut the whole thing down, which would be wonderful because it's just an absolutely useless facility, money sucking. It already caught on fire once, which I have no sympathy for. I don't care if the whole thing burned as long as no one dies. Just a bunch of computers, just a bunch of thieves. But this is what they do, is they gather, they're constantly lying, they gather dirt, they've been busted lying over and over again. They say, oh, well, we did that, but, you know, we weren't doing this, and then another leak comes out from Snowden, oh, yes, you were getting metadata, oh, yeah, you were tapping all the phones, oh, yes, you did spy on everyone, foreigners, it's not just terrorists, they're guilty. And we know this. But finally, we have a judge taking steps, probably one of the only judges they don't gather dirt on. Because I tell you, if you've read Classified Woman, it's a book by Sybil Edmonds. She talks about a conversation she had in there with Judge John Roberts, who said that the way they chose judges, the way they selected them, was by screening them and finding out that they did have skeletons in their closet, that they did have dirt. Because that means they'd have leverage over the judge. And those are the kinds of judges they wanted. So if anybody ever told you, if you ever plan on being a judge, you want to have a perfectly clean record because they screen you and they'll find out anything you've ever done. Actually, just the opposite. The more skeletons you have in your closet, the better, because that's the exact kind of judges they want. And I'll continue this story right after the break. We got a lot more news to cover. Stay with us, folks. Hey, welcome back. This is the What Really Happens show. I'm subbing for Mike Rivero. My name is Ryan Dawson. And I just heard the RBN pledge drive. And I do encourage all of you listeners, like, this is a simple thing. This is just, I'm going to throw this out there and I hope you will comply. If you were just to give a dollar, which is not going to break the bank for anybody, but even just a dollar, there are thousands of you listening, or tens of thousands sometimes. They could have, maybe $10,000 in an hour. They could pay just about everybody with that, if you'll do it. And I just really encourage you. I know you're just listening, and I'm getting ready to get back into the news, but just consider it, saying, I can give up a dollar today. It's not going to hurt you. But all right, okay. This is my piece. I really hope you will consider donating. Consider it a Christmas present if you like. Well, I was going to talk about the NSA, but I do have a caller from North Carolina, which is where I'm from, and I have a feeling it might be about what I was talking about 2 days ago. Mike in North Carolina, you are on the air.
Yep. Not about what you were talking about a couple of days ago, but I just had question. Do you have any idea of what kind of interest the United States has to pay the Federal Reserve on the money they borrow, like what percentage or whatever?
It's a very low interest rate, actually, but it's almost zero right now. But that doesn't matter, really. I mean, there shouldn't be any interest at all.
Exactly.
It's not just that. What it is the U.S. does borrow from the Federal Reserve, but they actually have another layer of stupid. What usually happens is the regional banks borrow from the Fed, and then they loan to the government at all different interest rates. So it's all hidden and convoluted. No, that's what happens. And they also borrow from central banks in China and other countries as well. Actually, China has the second highest amount of U.S. debt, followed by Japan. I think it's 9% and 7%. And most of it is owed to the American Central Bank itself, but I don't think it really matters where the location is. They have no loyalties to any piece of dirt.
Right. I was just trying to explain it to someone, and I used to try to explain if I could use a percentage. I was just wondering if there's a certain percent, but... No problem.
Well, it's near zero right now, and a lot of it the Fed actually loans out directly to the financial institutions that it's propping up. They don't even have to get it from the government. Sometimes the government is that intermediary, and I know there's a lot of films about the Fed and all that in the government, but actually the Fed just divvies it out to their friends, as we found from the Bloomberg report. The GOA did an audit of the Federal Reserve, And we found out they spent about $20 trillion, about $16 trillion in the first round. And it went to Citigroup and Bank of America and all these big financial institutions who bought up their competition. And this was separate from the public bailout that was on TV about the government, which it borrowed money and then lent it out. The Fed also did it solo, but completely in secret. And it was only because of that rare annual type, not even annual, it's like every 10 years or so, they finally had an audit. And it should have been the biggest news of the century, but it just got buried under a bunch of, you know, whatever, Michael Jackson, Tom Cruise, what, you know, celebrity gossip and sensationalism.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Enjoy your show.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, the interest rates are actually quite low, though.
Okay.
Okay. So, getting back to the NSA, I got another idea. I like a call into power. I mean, you guys, you listeners, if you work in unison, if we can organize this, just like I said about with RBN giving them a donation, you can have a major impact if we're proactive. And I'd like to bring down the NSA. I'd like to at least start the process. And I think a good place to start would be repealing the Patriot Act, because that's been the justification, as horrible as that piece of legislation is for a number of reasons. That's also been and currently is the fig leaf for the justification of the NSA's insane spy program. They're citing a certain paragraph in there saying, oh, we're allowed to do it because of the Patriot Act. So they have this guilty until proven innocent system going on. But I believe, sincerely, if we get proactive, and I know some people in the independent media will try and paralyze you and say that no matter what you do, it doesn't matter, and they're repeatedly fear-mongering, saying crap like you're all going to FEMA camps, and the government's going to release a biovirus and wipe out 80% of the population, and it just turn that mess off, because fear paralyzes, and you do matter, and you do affect things, and when they don't let anybody defeat your spirit, don't let anybody tell you, oh, it doesn't matter, they're just going to lock you up, and you can't do anything, that is not true. There are thousands of you, sometimes 10,000 of you listening to these programs on RBN, this show and other shows. And if you, at the break or after the show, you just called Congress demanding them to repeal the Patriot Act, I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight, but if we can do this the same way that Americans did to prevent the bombing in Syria, which if you asked anybody prior to that, it was a done deal, but they got 1,000 to 1 people calling in to say, no, don't bomb Syria. Nobody wanted another Iraq-type scenario. And that's because of the web. But we might have a shot at it. But I can guarantee you, if you don't call and you don't say anything at all, you got a 100% chance of nothing changing. And if you don't know your congressman's number or even who they are, you can go to a website called congress.org. And that's org, not com. And you can type in your zip code, and it'll give you your congressman, and it'll give you both your senators. And you just call those numbers. You're not going to get to talk to them directly. A legislative assistant in L.A. will answer the phone. And you just tell them your name, where you're from, maybe your occupation, because they like demographics, like to know how many teachers or construction workers or whatever called in. And you tell them that, you know, you would support your Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so repealing the Patriot Act. And they'll make a note of that. All they do is say, we had X number of people call and say they want this. And it's worth doing. It takes maybe a minute, half a minute of your time to just call in and say to whoever answers the phone that you're so-and-so from such and such place and you want to repeal the Patriot Act, and could you please pass that message on to the congressman? And they'll say, yes, thank you very much. And they're legally obligated to do that. And if the thousands of you call, it's going to make a difference. I mean, you don't have to do it once. You can do it every day. But we've got to be proactive. If we waste our time, it's not a total waste of time, but a lot of people are talking in circles. They post things on Facebook. So you're kind of preaching to the choir. These congressmen, they never see any of that. I mean, there's a lot of activism online. And people are getting more and more informed, and it's good to do that, and it's good information, and that's definitely a necessary step. But we have to take the second step, which is once you are informed and have this information, we have to organize, and we got to tell the people who aren't using the internet, who are not news savvy, which includes the Congress in state level and in the federal level. You've got to pick up the phone. Don't email them. They're not going to read it. You have to send them a physical letter, which will take forever, or call them. And if you live in the D.C. area, visit them. If you're in Virginia or Maryland, there's really no excuse. You take a trip down, you go into the Hart building, that's the Senate building, and you go right up to the door and say, I want to meet with so-and-so. They'll say they're busy and you can't. You say, when is somebody free to talk to me? And someone will be within the day, and you can lobby. You don't have to have money to be a lobbyist. I've done it before. That's when I was mentioning how I met McCain. I didn't go there with any money. I went there to yell at him, and I caught him in the hallway. We're lucky our forefathers gave us this system. And don't let anybody tell you that it doesn't matter, that voting doesn't matter and calling doesn't matter and activism doesn't matter. What doesn't matter is doing nothing. Just saying, well, I'm going to buy a bunch of guns and wait for doomsday. That is a horrible philosophy. Get the guns, sure. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being armed, and that's part of the Second Amendment. But we've got to be proactive. So I'm asking you, go to congress.org, get their number, call them today or later on. They're going to close at 5, actually. But make a note of it and say, you know, I think I'll call and tell them to repeal the Patriot Act or end aid to Israel or whatever your issue is. But we've got to do it in unison, and we've got to start doing it every day. That's my short little appeal and rant, and I'll get back to some news. But I don't think we spend enough time pushing proactive actions, and we spend a lot of time talking about what's wrong and not what we should be doing about it. So a little bit more right after the break. Get into Iceland. Aloha and ohayo gozaimasu and konnichiwa and good morning, good afternoon, etc. The number to call in is 800-313-9443. I want to cram in some news about Iceland because it's good news, and then I'm going to bring in some callers. As I said before, Iceland delivered jail sentences for 4 Kaupthing bankers. That's the biggest bank in Iceland. They go to jail. 2 of them got 5.5-year sentences, and 2 more got 3-year sentences. If only we could do that in America. What they were guilty of was called a pump and dump. They did a classic pump and dump of their bank shares. It's very similar to what the very first bank in America did, the first national bank. They claimed that a wealthy sheikh from Qatar, Khalif bin Hamad Al Thani, had purchased a multitude of shares in the bank. The reality was, well, he sort of did, but the reality was he just purchased them with money that originated from the Kaupthing Bank itself. So it just went in a circle. And, well, now they're all going to jail. So if only the U.S. had such a system of justice, but the U.S. doesn't have a system of justice, what we have is a legal system where as long as you have enough money, basically nothing's illegal. And you look at what they did with the mortgage-backed security fraud, where they were taking all the subprime loans and they packaged them together as CDOs, and they sold those off to third parties with faulty ratings because they got the ratings companies to lie and give them AAA ratings when they knew it was absolute Bernanke. And a lot of people lost all their money, and people were losing their houses. And just another crazy thing they did to get around insurance with the credit default swaps is mainly from Citigroup. They created these things called SIVs, or structure investment vehicle. And if you might be thinking, well, what's an SIV? In banking babble, an SIV, and forgive me for nerding out here for a second, but an SIV is a pool of investment assets that attempts to profit from credit spreads between short-term debt and long-term structured finance projects such as asset-backed securities, which is called ABS. Funding for it comes from the issuance of commercial paper that's continuously renewed, rolled over, and then the proceeds are invested in longer maturity assets that have less liquidity and pay higher yields. Okay, so in English, this means it's fraud. It's a fund that's usually offshore with an investment bank so that it can hide its obligations. For example, if an investment bank issues, let's say, $100 million worth of mortgages to homeowners, the bank can then create $100 million worth of IOUs and sell them to an SIV. So the IOUs and the mortgages are called mortgage-backed securities. That's what we mean by that term. And the SIV buys the mortgage-backed securities with cash because they are a separate company, and then the obligation on the debt is not recorded on the balance sheet for the investment bank. You see how the scandal's going? So the major problem is they buy bonds, the IOUs, the SIB is just simply selling their own bonds by using commercial paper. That's how they get the money for it. And commercial paper is just a promissory note that has to be repaid quickly after a set number of days, usually around 9 months at the max. They normally carry high interest, and they can only be created by corporations with excellent credit ratings. Well, the credit agencies are lying, first of all. So an SIV was just an invention of Citigroup, and that's the financial institution that got the largest bailout from the Federal Reserve, done completely in secret. And if to make it, I'm trying to make it even easier or more tangible. Let's say, imagine Alex borrows money from Bob and he loans it to Carl, right? If Alex can charge Carl more interest than Bob is charging Alex interest, then Alex will make money in the spread between the interest rates. But what if Bob is lending money to Alex that Bob got from Danny, who borrowed his from Emily, and so on? You see, the longer the chain is, the more dangerous it gets, the higher the interest has to be at the end of it, and the more foolish it all becomes, especially if Carl can't pay. It's a time bomb waiting to happen. That's exactly what they did. They got bailed out by the Fed. Utterly disgusting. But in Iceland, when they tried this Ponzi scheme, they ended up going to jail. All right, that's my little nerdy economic thing for today. Now I have a caller, Art in Philly, who I talked to yesterday about the Kennedys and the Mafia. Are you there?
Yes, Ryan. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I enjoyed the conversation yesterday.
Oh, thank you. Just wanted to make a comment on 2 points you talked about today. One is you're talking about judges. Give you an insight how I see this really works. I was helping a local person run for a third-party candidate run, and one of the lawyers helping his campaign out, Jan Chesey out of Bucks County, basically says for judges, he says, we look at judges as gods. We like to pay them off so we can control them. Okay, I'm surprised the guy isn't disbarred, but being a member of the legal society. So if you're wondering how they go about doing it, that's their thought processes of how they think about dealing with judges and getting them elected and how they try to control our legal system. And that's an effort that they are doing all the time. Just to give you some insight to that respect.
It's also like who's watching the watchers, Right. Everyone, a judge is in control of your whole life when you're in a court. And people who can pay him off or who have blackmail on them, it could be the carrot or the stick, get away with bloody murder.
Yeah, pretty much. But it's more
literally.
I agree. I've seen it happen where I am. But primarily the major effort is they are trying to set up the control of getting the person elected so that they owe them favors in case one of their lawyers comes up with a case they want to be dealt with in their favor. Now, with respect to Depository Trust Clearing Corporation, when I actually worked there, give you an idea what it's like. It's like musical chairs where they're switching around a hot potato. What they have is a trading system, which is a private trading system, very similar like the New York Stock Exchange. And the security on it is you have trading partners like J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, on down the line. And they sign an agreement that if one of them defaults, then proportional to their investment in the company, the trading system, they will absorb the loss that has occurred. Okay? But what they do is they get these blocks of mortgages, Jenny Mae's, Fannie Mae's, and all that, and one company like, Citibank will say the block has 100 mortgages in there, and they'll have one that's in default or ready to go in default, and then they trade it that day. Okay? So the buyer might be Bank of America. They don't get to see the financial integrity of that trading block until they actually own it and bid on it. That's one of the faults of the system. There's no security, there's no financial rating of the financial instruments until after they're traded. So what happens is one company gets, one bad mortgage in a pool of mortgages in their Jenny Mae or Fannie Mae. Next thing you know, someone else will trade a day or a few days later, one or two. After they get two bad mortgages, someone else will trade at three. And you can see how that creates a chain reaction, almost like a nuclear financial chain reaction, which causes a meltdown. And that's basically what happened in the situation there.
Why would they be buying blind? Like they don't have a rating on what they're about to get. Why would they buy it at all?
That beats the heck out of me. I don't understand why they do that, but they do it. And the other thing I saw was when they're there, when you apply for a mortgage,
I guess because they're gambling with other people's money usually, so they don't care.
Right. And like I said, there's been
For real, like for a lot of retirement funds and stuff, this is a little different, but they actually legally have to only buy AAA rated things because they have to be the most secure things. But when the rating doesn't matter because they've lied about everything and it really ended up just being a bunch of subprime junk, they bought them out completely. But the thing is, the investment banks, the lending institutions didn't have the burden responsibility because they went out and loaned as much as they wanted and then sold them to the investment banks so that when the person, if they were paying their monthly mortgage, the payment went to the investment bank, not to the lenders. And so the lenders really didn't care whether they paid it back or not, because if they didn't pay it back, it wasn't their loss because they had already sold it off. And then yeah. The investment banks did the same thing with their securities to all, and so on. But music's coming. Tell me more about that and judges too if you want right after the break.
Okay.
And we're back. This is Ryan Dawson filling in for Mike Rivero. I have Art on the line who worked at the DTCC, which I've been writing a book about, interested in this. And we were talking about the financial scandal and judges, and I just went over the split between investment banks and the lending institutions and how they're all, you know, passing it off the house that Jack built and chucking responsibility. And then they furthermore went around the state regulations on insurance by getting credit default swaps and SIVs. And Art was talking about other methods of debauchery in the financial institution where they're buying blind and sticking each other with these bad assets, which were created through deception.
Right.
Art, are you still there? I guess.
Yes. The way it started was companies like Countrywide, which were the gatekeepers through this financial system, started hiring people, you know, just off the streets, no training, as mortgage
brokers. Well, they hired Chris Dodd, who was in, in the Senate, the head of the banking committee, and right. They gave him special mortgages on his own multiple properties, including in D.C.
Right, and that's, as a result of that, they looked the other way. And the system was based on what they called due diligence of the mortgage brokers, making sure that the financial viability of the person borrowing the money was there. And, you know, when it went down to, like, you know, zero down and, you know, no doc, no income verification, no doc loans, it just opened up the floodgates, and that's when it really, you know, snowballed. So.
Not only no doc loans, but they suckered a lot of these people on with adjustable rate mortgage type teaser rates that completely skyrocketed 2 years later.
Yes. There still was a big problem in the inner cities and the lower income areas, what they call predatory lending. And they, like you said, they used variable rate mortgages that give you a teaser rate for the first couple of years, and then they skyrocket up through the roof afterwards for the next 27, 25 years.
Simultaneous to that, the Fed also jacked its rates up and then later reversed and opened the discount window to the bankers, but that didn't trickle down, and it never does.
Right. Well, Reagan started the idea, trickle-down effect.
I just wanted to get that phrase in there because it's funny, but I mean what I said, though.
But if you look at right now, if you actually went on the website dtcc.com and you look at the executive bios, you will see that, you know, the fox is in the henhouse. You know, where is the oversight to make sure that they don't do it again? I mean, the real lesson we should have learned from this is they got away with $20 trillion. Why are they not going to try to get away with $200
trillion? Yeah, well, they also were the great enablers for all the naked short selling, which is illegal, by the way. I don't care what Wikipedia says or not. I mean, anybody can edit it, and I'm sure they can just pay somebody to sit there and make sure it says what they wanted to. Actually, the fellows from Overstock.com and another guy did a great little presentation about naked shorts, if you would like that explained with visuals, which also involved the DTCC, which that's not their name anymore, but I highly recommend that. But I've got, Art, I've got five more callers in a row hitting the lines up. You're welcome to call back, but I'm going to let you go and take Jim in Georgia. Jim, are you there?
Yes. How are you doing?
Sir. I'm all right.
I've got a question. I know when they float a bond or some kind of tax to build a stadium or a highway or a bridge, that it has to be voted on by the people of the county or the city or the state, who okays this money to go to the $80 billion a month to go to Wall Street, or money that goes to Israel and all these places? Is it done by the senators? Is it done by Congress? Who okays this? Has one person got the okay to do this? Ooh.
Well,
I'd like to know who has the power to okay giving this money.
On the federal level, for example, the aid to Israel, which is actually just free money, that would go. That's part of the foreign aid and U.S. aid, and it has to go through appropriations first. It's the committee in Congress, and then the Senate will pass it. But the way that is automatic. I mean, since Robert Byrd died, the Senate votes 100-0 for aid to Israel every single time. As far as bridges and things like that, your state is paying for its own highways, except for the interstate. New bridges, okay. Of course, if you listen to a couple of days ago, they're not building a lot of the bridges that they're supposed to be. And they will build bridges in Iraq and other places, for example. But actually, when you really look at that, a lot of them were contracted to build them, and they didn't actually end up ever getting built, but the money disappeared anyway. As for the $80 billion to Wall Street, that came from the bailouts, which also started in appropriations. And we really all lost the money because they take money from the states, and who takes it from you. And your property taxes pay for public schools and in all but two states.
I understand that. What I'm asking is, who gives the okay, like the $80 billion to Wall Street and that? One man.
Oh, well, that came from the Congress and the President, starting from the Appropriations Committee.
So our senators and our Congress people are the ones that give the okay.
Yep, and the President, because the President could have vetoed it and didn't.
Right.
In fact, the Presidents were both Bush and Obama wrote the bills that they sent to Congress. Their administrators wrote them up, and then Congress pushed them through. The first one was denied to Bush. The Republicans actually shot down the first round of bailouts. But later on, they all passed, as did Obama's stimulus package. And then with the secret bailout from the Fed, nobody had to okay that. The Fed just did it and didn't have to listen to anybody.